The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Riley, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, all, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals for this February 18 panel, or perhaps I should say welcome to your living rooms, workspaces, bathrooms, or wherever you might be today. I'll just state for the record what the parties are already aware of, which is that our oral argument today is being conducted through a Zoom platform online rather than live at the Minnesota Judicial Center. But for the party's reference, we will be recording the proceedings only audibly for presentation to the public on our website, as is always our ordinary course. So for that reason, even though we can see each other and each other's names, please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so we can keep track of who's making which argument on the audio recording of things. And speaking of recording, I'll just remind everyone who may be present for these proceedings that our rules strictly prohibit any video recording of the proceedings today. So we expect everyone to abide by that rule. Counsel, each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument. And I will state that the first case on for oral argument today is Fafinski versus Johnson. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal argument if you choose to use it. And with those preliminary instructions, counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chad McKinney on behalf of appellant Doug Johnson. We're here because the court awarded $93,000 on a MUFTA violation in a manner that's never been done before under Minnesota law, generally awarding damages against my client, who everyone admits was not a debtor of Jaron Johnson, was not a debtor of BPLG, the law firm at issue. This has never been done before, and it's not the purpose of MUFTA. My client is a 76-year-old retired subcontractor who's the father of Jaron Johnson, who is a former employer of the respondent. They had owned a law firm together. Jaron Johnson bought out Mr. Fafinski, and my client, the father, personally signed and guaranteed on a loan and eventually wound up having to pay off $597,000 of his own money and receive nothing. Timelines are important here. We have made an appeal here indicating that there really is no support for the court's use of MUFTA and alleging damages against my client. Everybody admits that my client had no role with the law firm. Not a lawyer, was not an owner, employer, not a debtor of the law firm. No role with the law firm. Everybody admits my client has no obligation to pay his son's debts. So, how did we get here? Mr. Fafinski brought claims against BPLG, the law firm, for unpaid wages, and his first judgment for a discovery issue of slightly over $1,100 was obtained on September, or prior to September of 11. That's it, $1,100. My client, who personally guaranteed the loan that Jaron Johnson used to pay off the respondent, became due. It was late. The banker said, we're going to call your guarantee due on this loan. My client on September 26 paid $597,000. Now, respondents in the court made an issue about, well, gee, the ultimate pledge agreement that's issued is in your name, but Western Comfort Limited Partnership paid that off. It's a partnership solely owned by my client. And again, I think the district court misunderstood the way transactions work. My client, who solely owns an entity, Western Comfort, paid it off, but it was on his guarantee. There's no law that says you can't assign or take a pledge agreement personally when you personally pay off a personal guarantee. So we get to September 26, he pays off the loan. Then there's a pledge agreement that his son creates and it's dated January 1st of 2012. The only judgment that is applicable at that time.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that is when it was deemed effective, but there's no date by the signature line. So we really don't know when it was created.
So in fact, you're correct. And it is my client's position that he was never aware of it and it was not created at all as to him. This was something.
Well, it's, you know, that we give deference to the district court's findings of fact. And the district court, after the trial in this matter, determined that she did not find your client or his son credible with regard to this pledge agreement.
Right, but there was no evidence submitted by the respondents that he had any knowledge of it. There was a fax line from an attorney saying, got this from my client. Attorney didn't show up. Nobody was there. There was no testimony of any person that my client was ever aware.
Well, let me ask you about this, because the district court found that the pledge agreement transferred all of the firm's assets to your client or pledged them, and that there was a transfer of those. You say that the transfer was never perfected, nothing was ever filed. There are a couple of exceptions to the UCC filing requirement. One is control and one is possession.
Okay.
And that's, and the district court cited the case of Goza versus Fairmont National Bank. It's a older case from 1972, but it's still good law.
The district court found in conclusion of law 13, while defendant did not perfect his security interest by filing, he maintained control. That goes against the clear testimony and everything that was put into the court and, in fact, the appellant's admissions.
Well, the Goza case doesn't talk about control. It talks about transfer. And right. It says the transfer of possession necessary to a valid pledge does not require a manual delivery of the pledge property by the pledgor or a manual receipt of it by the pledgee.
Admitted, understood, Your Honor, but there was no transfer because there's no testimony my client took any possession. In fact, the only testimony by both parties was that the law firm retained the assets. Keep in mind, the only assets we're talking about are the law firm or the accounts receivable. That's it. There was a computer, which was valueless. So we're talking about accounts receivable. All parties agree.
I think that the evidence in the record is that about 85% of the assets at the time of this pledge agreement were accounts receivable.
The only assets of any value that any party has claimed are the accounts receivable, Your Honor. There's a computer server which my client kept. So I'd respectfully disagree with that. The only issue that respondents are taking is that it's the accounts receivable. And let me get to your transfer question, because that's important. The definition of transfer under MUFTA says that you have to part with the asset. There is no dispute that BPLG did not part with the asset. In fact, it's the exact opposite. We've got evidence that's admitted by respondent that BPLG tried to continue to collect on the assets after 2012. In fact, they hired a third-party firm to collect on the assets. That's the exhibit 104. And that exhibit basically says these files are worthless. So between, that's dated April 19th of 2013, exhibit 104. Between then and October of 2015, when a judgment is obtained against Jaron Johnson, then there's no activity by anybody on these issues. There's never been a claim that my client took any action. In fact, that the respondents have admitted at trial transcript 95, my client received nothing, did not get any money, didn't take control or possession of these assets because the accounts receivable retained were retained by the law firm who tried to collect on their own, hired a third party. So we don't believe transfer occurred. It wasn't parted. And in fact, the pledge agreement exhibit 20 makes clear that it conveys a first priority security interest. That's it. They're not parting with it. The law firm kept that. I would like to, so in the grand scheme of things, MUFTA is set up to say, okay, if a debtor takes an asset and puts it out of reach of the creditor, that's what we're trying to deal with. The remedies are, if I'm a creditor and somebody gives me a preferential fraudulent transfer of an asset, the remedies are disgorge it. There's nothing to disgorge. Respondents have already admitted my client received nothing. In fact, the court has made such a finding that she admits at finding 79, which she revised, which says defendant did not receive any money from the accounts receivable or pledged assets.
To another question I have. So you contend or you assert that the judge made erroneous findings of fact and conclusions of law, and you go through a number of them. I'm confused because, as I understand it, at the May 2020 hearing, you in fact withdrew your challenges to findings of fact 65, 66, 111, 112, 113, and 114, and to conclusions of law 125, 8, 90, or 68, 77, and 78. And so is that true that you withdrew?
That is true. Yes.
Well, then why are you raising them on this appeal?
They're raised to tell, so for example, they say the court correctly stated the law. That's why we remove the request at the court, but it's stated to say they interpreted it wrong. It's for factual information. So if that was inartfully stated in the brief, we've admitted those are gone. That doesn't affect the basic intent of MUFTA does not, everybody agrees my client is not a debtor. They are not a debtor. MUFTA does not allow the law to say BPLG debts, Jaron Johnson debts, somehow my client becomes responsible for those debts. That's what's happening here, and that's never been done before.
I just want to clarify what exactly you are appealing, because when you stated the issues at the beginning of your brief, it looks like you're appealing from the summary judgment motion because there were still factual issues to be resolved.
That we're appealing from the summary judgment stating that the defendant or the plaintiff did not present any evidence of damages, a required element of the claim, and the court didn't find that. And we're also appealing.
Mr. McKinney, I'm speaking. My question is that you can't appeal from a motion for summary judgment after you've had a trial. Aren't you? I was just confused by how you framed your issues.
Your Honor, we're highlighting the theme that the court erred continually throughout the case. We've appealed from errors of conclusions of law and errors of findings from the court trial. We're highlighting the motion for summary judgment stating throughout this time, there's been no evidence of any damages sustained by their client, a required element. So we've set out the appeals of the findings regarding the transfers. So we've got conclusion of law 13, conclusions of law 24, 29, 41. We've laid out the conclusions and they all focus around there was no transfer. Everyone admits my client received no money. In fact, they've agreed with that. They've said, yep, you've received nothing. Nobody says my client took possession of the accounts receivable. There's been nothing done by him on it. And the only debts that they're asking that he be responsible for are not allowed under MUFTA. MUFTA says, if I'm a creditor and I put things out of the reach of other parties, then you can disgorge and take that back from me. Understood. But when it's admitted, my client got nothing. And they agree. Nobody's disagreeing that my client received nothing. then there is nothing to disgorge. Now, making the leap to say, okay, we all admit that your client received nothing, but now what we're going to do is take an unprecedented remedy and say, you know what, even though we admit you're not a debtor to Beat PLG, even though we admit you're not a debtor to Darren Johnson, we're going to make you responsible somehow, because Darren Johnson, the allegation is he created some fraudulent pledge agreement. My client didn't receive anything from it. There is nothing to disgorge, and he's not a debtor. I would draw the court's attention to a 2020 case, Kelly versus Trustees of PCI Liquidating, 974 Fed Third 884, interpreting MUFTA. And the court makes clear, it deals with the Ponzi scheme about early lenders seeking to claw back interest payments on payments violated MUFTA. And in particular, it says, even though the promissory notes the lenders gave and the money they gave was used for an ongoing fraud scheme, there was no evidence that lenders working the scheme to deceive had any engagement in those activities. There is no engagement by my client in the activities, regardless of the fact that he's not a debtor. He's not responsible for BPLG's debts, plaintiffs or Jaron Johnson's debts. And I've never seen any case that cited that MUFTA applies to a situation where a debtor does not exist. My client's not a debtor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McKinney. Counsel for respondent.
I need to unmute myself. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. Just to, I guess, piggyback real quick on what counsel was saying at the end there. It doesn't matter that that appellant's not a debtor in this case. He is the transferee. And under 513, 47 and 48, MUFTA allows judgment against the transferee. And the court is allowed to fashion the remedy that it deems necessary to compensate respondent in this matter. So this idea and focus that that the appellant is not a debtor in this case matters not. We're looking at this through the conduct of the debtor and the transferee as being the receiver of the assets being transferred.
Can you focus on that for a minute and articulate as clearly as you can the evidence that the appellant was a receiver of the accounts receivable?
Sure. The pledge agreement by itself identifies that all the assets are being transferred to Douglas Johnson, not his partnership, not any other third party, to Douglas Johnson. The court is correct that it does not require you to have a physical possession of the assets being transferred. Control possession is two ways to do it. Here, the pledge agreement is self-perfecting in that format, Your Honor. It provides the transfer to Douglas Johnson, and at the same time, Douglas Johnson is providing a revocable license to the law firm BPLG to hold these assets and collect monies. The testimony at trial was, he says, I never received it. However, he disqualifies himself from ever saying that he didn't receive it because he clearly testified that he doesn't have a clear recollection of the events of 2011 and 2012. Jaron Johnson, his son, admitted that he created the document and could not recall whether or not he sent it to his father or not. So he has disqualified himself with respect to the trail of this pledge agreement. What we do have is Douglas Johnson's admissions in response to requests for admissions, admitting he received the pledge. What we do have is a fax from his lawyer sent to me on the eve of the sheriff's sale to execute on the receivables, saying, Douglas Johnson sent this to me. You can't have these. That's the testimony we have. So we have two people who can't recall, and we have conflicting evidence that says he did receive it, And what happens in that situation, Your Honor, is that the court has to look at the evidence, give it the proper weight, determine credibility. Here, the credibility was found that both Mr. and Mr. Johnson were incredible. And she had to weigh the evidence, and this panel has to give that decision deference. There's just no way around it. This court can't go back and change the facts. You have the facts as they are, and the trial court's in the best situation to determine credibility.
Mr. Rose, let me ask you this. So the pledge agreement specifically talks about cash, inventory, fixtures, fittings, machinery, apparatus, equipment, and accounts receivable and any other property. So under the UCC, there are those two exceptions, control and possession, which may apply to everything except accounts receivable. And as I read the UCC as codified at 336.9-102, in order to perfect an interest in a transfer of accounts receivable, there has to be a UCC filing. And I don't think there's any evidence of a filing.
There is no evidence of a filing, Your Honor, but there is definitely control and possession.
But do those exceptions apply to accounts receivable or just to all of the other things that I listed in that pledge agreement?
I would say it applies to everything, Your Honor.
Can you point me to a statute or a case that supports that?
Not today, I cannot.
So let me ask you this question. Assume I'm right that you have to perfect your interest in accounts receivable through a UCC filing. Then what we have here, and I know that Mr. McKinney disagrees with my math, but the assets were valued at $3.3 million when the pledge agreement was deemed effective, and the accounts receivable was 86% of that. So what if we determine, based on the law, that those accounts receivable were never transferred? What do we do if some of the assets in the pledge agreement were transferred and some weren't? If you understand my question.
I think I understand your question, Your Honor. I think what you're saying is that even if you're right and the UCC filing didn't happen and it was required to, can you still find in favor of my client? And you can. You're right. Looking at Exhibit 25 in the record identifies what the assets were. And looking at that, I believe the total assets were $3.8 million. Now, a large part of that was the receivables. The other equipment makes up the balance of that. So those items were transferred as well under the pledge agreement. The pledge agreement gave him physical control or gave him access to it. He allowed them to have it, and manual delivery isn't required, Your Honor, according to the law. So you can take the value of those other items and apply them to this case, and we still are at our number of $93,000, Your Honor.
How about the argument that the damages calculation isn't appropriate and that instead all the court had the option to do was disgorgement?
That's just not right. That is an option, but it's not an option that the court must undertake. 513, 46, and 47 identify that a judgment can happen against the transferee. And that the court can fashion any remedy it deems needed to remedy the situation. So while disgorgement might be a factor that can happen, it doesn't have to happen. And it didn't happen in this situation because at the time of trial, these assets are depleted to the point of not being nominal at this point. And so there is no remedy by disgorgement. And so he's asking a remedy that doesn't provide a remedy. So the court fashioned a remedy that actually provides a remedy, and the damages are calculated from the judgments that have been acquired over this past decade. Mr. Fafinski earned these wages 10 years ago. He has chased these wages for 10 years. It's time that he gets paid. And, you know, I asked for attorney's fees too, Your Honor, and that was denied. And so be it. And maybe she felt that the 65,000 attorney's fees was offset by the 93,000, and he still nets 30,000, which is right around the total judgment in the first action. So her math gets us to a full recovery. And I don't understand why there's this only one option that he's putting forward. It just isn't the law. And according to, I would like to get back, getting to the standard of review, Your Honor. I agree that the standard of review here is a clearly erroneous standard and error of law and an abuse of discretion standard. Appellant here has not provided any evidence that she was wrong with her decision. What we have here is 8 badges of fraud out of 11. So we've identified that the pledge agreement has been transferred to the appellant. We have 8 of the 11 badges of fraud. They include a transfer to an insider. There's just no doubt that that occurred. Appellant is the debtor's father. The debtor retained possession of the assets to the revocable license. The concealment occurred. Nobody knew about the pledge agreement until the eve of the sheriff's sale. The debtor had been sued several times. The transfer was all of the assets, 3.8 million of them. The numbers, Your Honor, if I recall, is 33,000 thereabouts in equipment and 71,000 in furniture and fixtures. So again, we're at our number. The equivalent value was not provided at the time of the transfer. Here we have a situation in which the initial loan from First Dakota National Bank was paid off in 2011. From 2011, September 2011 to January 1st of 2012, these assets were unencumbered and available for attachment. The transfer occurred on January 1, 2012. That's the effective date. For a payment of $600,000 that never happened on January 1, 2012, there was no new value. Testimony is clear that there was no payment made in January 2012. Therefore, there was no equivalent value. Even if you are to take a look at the debt, BPLG's alleged debt at that time was $43,636. Which means the transfer was more than 90 times more than the debt at the time of the transfer. Insolvency has been met. The definition is that the debtor generally cannot pay the debts as they become due. Clearly the testimony here says they were unable to pay their debts. In fact, by January 1st, 2012, they had ceased doing business. The transfer occurred shortly before or after substantial debt was incurred. Here we're in the middle of a trial. The parties are awaiting the end, the decision of the court, and in the meantime, he's transferring all of his assets, and the judgment that comes out in the first action is $30,150. So we've met all the badges of fraud, and what do the badges of fraud mean? It means that the transfer was done with the intent to hinder, delay, and defraud. Also, what the court has found, and what appellant has not appealed, which by definition means his appeal must fail, is that she found constructive fraud, and that there was the badges of fraud that I just mentioned were met, in addition to finding that there was an antecedent debt and that there was knowledge of the insolvency. The appellant knew there was insolvency, or we had reason to know there was insolvency. He helped close up the building. He knew that the loan wasn't being paid. He knew that the debts weren't being paid. So we have constructive fraud as well. So, and he hasn't appealed that decision. And getting back to the remedy, which I've already discussed at length, with respect to the amended findings and facts, this court can't go in and change the facts. This is an error finding court, and the relief that he's asking for with respect to his facts and amendments aren't appropriate. And I agree with the court, Judge Riley's opinion on the summary judgment issue. I agree the summary judgment orders are not appealable at this point in time. I provided that in my brief, that the decisions on the denial of summary judgment was based on fact issues, not matters of law, and therefore they're not appealable. This transaction is a fraudulent transfer. If this transaction is not a fraudulent transfer, I don't know what is. The pledge agreement identifies a note. There is no note. The pledge agreement doesn't have. There's just so many things that are wrong with it that it was done solely to hinder and delay respondent from collecting his amounts that were owed to him. And this is what MUFTA is for. The purpose is to protect the creditors and not allow debtors to put things beyond their reach, which they did. And if there's any other good questions, I think I'm done.
There do not appear to be any other questions from the panel. Thank you, Mr. Rose. Any rebuttal?
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. A couple of things on the perfection piece. The court found conclusion law 13, it was not perfected. So there's a conclusion that they didn't apply correctly because it's our position. If it's not perfected, it's not effective as to the accounts receivable.
Can I ask you a big picture question?
Yes.
Do you agree that if the evidence is sufficient to support the finding that the accounts receivable represented only 85% of the value of the assets, that your argument based upon a lack of transfer is not a sufficient basis to reverse?
I do not, because to begin with, the testimony from the trial for Veronica Cooch, my client's son, was that the value of these accounts receivable were worthless. They were zero. And that common sense would say this whole $3.8 million, basically it's what's on the books. Hey, I'm an attorney, I build people, and on the books it's $3.8 million. That is irrelevant. In fact, what happens is you try to collect on those. There's testimony that they tried to collect on those, and the accountant, Veronica Cooch, said, I just listed the accounts receivable statement. There was no value. In fact, she testified they're worthless. My client testified they're worthless. And the common sense would say they're worthless because they hired a third party. And that exhibit 104, the third party said, it is our determination that none of the files are viable. Wrong addresses, other people have bankruptcies, etc. So on the perfection piece, I think they lose on that to begin with. Keep in mind, my client didn't take possession of anything, didn't receive any money, etc. But counsel is, I believe, incorrect in this remedy. There is no case law and there is no support under 513.47 to have a judgment against a transferee if they did not receive assets. So the key piece is finding 79 by the court and the admissions by respondent at trial transcript 97. My client didn't get any money. So we all agree with that. If my client didn't receive anything, there is no law. 513.47 says you can avoid the transfer or you can get a judgment against a debtor. Does not say you can get a judgment against a transferee. You can get it to disgorge assets, but you can't take the leap. And what counsel just said is exactly correct. His client's got a claim for wages against BPLG and it's about time he gets paid. I don't disagree with that. It's who he gets paid from. I agree he has a claim against BPLG. I agree he has a claim against Jaron Johnson to get paid. There is no law and no support anywhere that somehow, because there's a pledge agreement, and even if my client got the pledge agreement, that somehow we make a leap to say, okay, you're responsible for Mr. Fafinski's back wages of $15,000, which then accumulates to $30,000 to $40,000 to attorney's fees. It just, there is no support in the law to make my client responsible for BPLG or Jaron Johnson's debts. There isn't. And MUFTA is not for that purpose.
Mr. McKinney, I didn't see in your appeal that you appealed the court's findings that there was both actual and constructive fraud.
We absolutely did. We appealed, and in our conclusion, the actual fraud is everything before 66, and we appealed finding 66, stating it was incorrect. That is the constructive fraud. Constructive fraud starts at 63, and we did appeal in our motion to the district court and to this court.
But at that May hearing, you withdrew your challenge to that.
No, I did not. No, I did not withdraw 66.
It was a finding of fact 66.
Yeah. No, we did not ever give in on our constructive fraud claim. We appealed conclusion of law 66, which is that he transferred all the assets under constructive fraud. So again, I just leave the court with, there is no case making this leap that my client, who's not a debtor, who didn't receive any money, all admittedly, is responsible for a wage claim of Mr. Fafinski.
Thank you, Mr. McKinney. Thank you, Mr. Rose, for your briefing.
Thank you.
On behalf of your clients, we appreciate both your briefing and your oral arguments today. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory period.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.